Coffee and Chromosomes is brought to you by the charity Wouldn't Change a Thing, creating a world where negative perceptions of Down syndrome are a thing of the past. If you would like to hear more about a certain topic or even from a particular individual, then please get in touch with us. Email us at podcast@wouldn'tchangeathing.org and we'll do our best to try and make it happen. Welcome to another episode of Coffee and Chromosomes. Today we're going to be talking about an area that generally seems to get pushed to the bottom of the priority list in the early days of a child's life. It's a really important area that needs to be given the right support and attention, and that is vision and what that journey looks like for an individual who has Down syndrome or additional needs. Now today we are really lucky to be joined by specialist optometrist and senior lecturer at Cardiff University, a name that I'm sure will be very familiar to many of you listening, and it's none other than the wonderful Maggie Woodhouse. Welcome, Maggie. Thank you so much for joining us. I wanted to start by talking about how you actually came to do what you do. And I think it's really quite fascinating because you almost fell into your specialism after realizing that individuals with additional needs were just not catered for correctly in local communities. Is that right? And can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yes. Thanks for the introduction, by the way. Yes, you're absolutely right. I stumbled into it by accident. And it was an area that took me completely by surprise. What happened was that my colleagues and I were interested in how squints and lazy eyes develop in children. So we opened up a children's clinic, and to our surprise, very few typical children came along to the clinic. And we think that's because they were very well catered for at the local hospital. But the people that did come along were children and some adults with disabilities. Now, until that point, the idea of providing eye care for people with disabilities just hadn't been on our horizon at all. I was brought up in the 50s and 60s at a time when people with disabilities were hidden from view.
Yeah.
Children were given up by their parents to be raised in these huge institutions, hospitals. So the general public never met people with disabilities. We didn't even see them in the street. And certainly when I qualified, the idea of providing eye care had never entered my head. So when these individuals turned up at our clinic telling us that they were hoping they could get some help from us because they didn't know where else to go, it was a huge learning curve for us. And we looked at the literature, obviously, and there were some papers published detailing the prevalence of visual problems among residents of these huge institutions. And there were some horrific numbers of people who had actually gone blind from conditions that would have been treated in the general population, but had been completely ignored in these individuals with disabilities. And unfortunately, those publications didn't seem to rattle any cages. I think because they were just looked at as items of interest by research scientists, because the general public still didn't know anything about people with disabilities. But we were then timing our clinic because our clinic, and certainly the build-up of our clinic, coincided with the idea of closing, political decision to close these large institutions and provide what was called care in the community, which became a bit of a buzzword at the time, but which now isn't used at all because everyone lives within the community. And these days we all take it for granted. So little by little, word was getting out there. And I think we were lucky. We were very, very lucky to be contacted by parents and carers of people with disability, because I've had the privilege ever since then and we're talking 35 to 40 years of working exclusively with people with disabilities, because once we realised what a huge need there was, it just became my only focus of interest. And I built then my research career and my clinical career entirely on that, mainly on vision in children with Down syndrome, because they seemed to be the ones had the most likelihood of getting problems. And their problems were very, very surprising, and therefore, from a research point of view, absolutely fascinating. And putting those problems right made such an enormous difference to the lives and achievements of children with Down syndrome that, as I say, privilege is the only word.
Oh, you know what? It's actually, hearing you say that now, you know, 35 years ago, the problems that were found because they just hadn't been addressed, actually 35 years is not long ago at all. And it's actually quite heartbreaking to think, you know, so many have been, it's just been an injustice really, just because, I mean, I guess it hits home that it's very recent that the input is being given and the right support is being found and still being looked into and developed. And it just shows that actually our children can still go so far, and actually knowing where they might plateau is still quite unknown if it's only 35 years ago.
Absolutely, yes.
Both sad and exciting. Yeah. It's sad because it's only 35 years ago where they were treated in the way in which they were. Exciting though, because actually, you know, with the work that is being put in now, you know, people should be optimistic to say, you know, if we put in the work now, early as possible, actually, we could achieve so much for them.
Yes, yeah. 35 years ago, the expectations of children with Down syndrome were very, very low indeed. And at the time, no one knew anything about how children with Down syndrome learned. So they were considered ineducable.
Yeah.
Because people had tried to teach them in the same way as they teach typical children. And then we had that huge amount of research coming out of Portsmouth, the Downs Educational Unit, which made a huge difference to our understanding of how they learn. That now expectations are much, much higher and getting higher all the time.
Yeah.
And as you say, we haven't got there yet.
No, we haven't.
We're not doing it perfectly yet. It's still ongoing.
Yeah.
But who knows
exactly
where the children are going to reach.
Yeah.
And it's certainly miles higher than they did 35 years ago.
I think it's interesting and to some extent frustrating that whilst, because of the research, there's been things put into play that means that they, as you say, can go on and achieve so much. However, the prognosis from early on, from any doctor that you speak to, and I'm sure anyone listening would have experienced something similar, which is that, you know, it's in line with perhaps expectations of 35 years ago, still today. And that doesn't tally, because you're like, actually, you know, any child that is born into the world with any sort of disability today will get an extensive amount of support at a base level. It's still not consistent right across the board, but that support, that basic support level, means actually they will go on to do things that previously we hadn't ever expected. And it's not as dark and gloomy as perhaps it's often portrayed.
Yes, yeah. The information that parents get before and after birth is lagging behind, isn't it? You're right. I mean, you know, it might not be quite as bad as it was 35 years ago when parents are just told, oh, put your child in this hospital and go home and have a proper one. You know, it's still, there's an enormous amount of improvement to do. And I'm still hearing horror stories of what are told and how the children are sometimes referred to and treated. Well, we shouldn't really be going off off-piste, should we? But we'll have a rant. All this business about screening, places like Iceland celebrating the fact that they are doing away with Down syndrome, I mean, it's just appalling. It's just a nightmare scenario. And it doesn't fit with, to my mind, at all, with the way society seems to be moving in other directions.
Well, especially progressive societies.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's retrogressive, isn't it? I mean, it's absolutely appalling, that sort of attitude, that we should rid the world of people with Down syndrome by terminations.
Yeah.
It's just awful. Right, especially when, talk about eyes.
Yeah, I just to add there, especially when all the research shows that 97 or 98% of families that have a young person or adult with Down syndrome in consider themselves much happier than what they were prior to that young person coming into their life. So there's a massive disparity going on. But anyway, we digress. Tell us a little bit about vision. How are babies' vision with Down syndrome different to typically developing babies?
Right. So let's start at birth. And when children are born, all children, and that includes children with Down syndrome and typical children, can have a wide range of long sight and short sight. So many will at birth be substantially long sighted or maybe short sighted. And typical children very quickly grow out of that. Most of the growth happens in the first year of life, a little bit more when they hit toddler stage. But by the age of four, very few children, probably about 6% of typical children, will need to wear glasses, will be long-sighted or short-sighted enough to need to wear spectacles. And all of the other children have grown out of those baby errors. Now, children with Down syndrome start off with exactly the same range of long sight and short sight as typical children.
Okay.
But they don't grow out of it.
Okay.
So some of the children start out in the middle, if you like, without long or short sight and stay there. But the others develop greater long sight or greater short sight, so that by the time children with Down syndrome hit four, 60% will be long-sighted or short-sighted enough to wear spectacles. Most are on the long-sighted side, and only about 9 or 10% are short-sighted. And of course, there's 40% of children that don't need to wear specs, but the majority of them will have a need for spectacles because they have not followed the trend of growing out of it.
Okay.
Now, we don't know how typical children manage to grow out of it. There's quite a lot of research in it, but we don't yet fully understand it. So we certainly don't understand why children with Down syndrome don't grow out of these errors. And it doesn't apply just to children with Down syndrome either. It certainly applies to children with cerebral palsy, which is the only other condition that's been studied in any depth. But it probably applies to children with all forms of disability as well, but they don't grow out of their baby errors. So whatever disability you have, you are much more likely to need to wear spectacles by the time you go to school.
Okay. I don't recall when Kush was born it ever being mentioned that we should get his eyes checked at any point. Should we have been doing something from birth?
I'm very surprised you say that, actually, Misha, because I thought that most health authorities had pathways for all children with Down syndrome, so that all children would be referred through the hospital eye service to an eye clinic, not close to birth.
Okay.
For most authorities, it will be between 18 months and 2 years.
Yeah, that is when it happened, yeah.
Right, but I'm surprised that nobody ever told you that that would happen.
No.
because some parents start to get worried. You know, they've got a little one and they don't know that they will get to this pathway sooner or later. And so they're getting anxious about, you know, my child is now approaching a year old and he or she has never had their eyes tested. Mm-hmm. So I'm surprised that that is not part of what at least your pediatrician.
The interesting thing is the research is overwhelming in that children with Down syndrome, adults with Down syndrome are visual learners. As such, actually, you know, the learning disability that is prevalent all the way through actually can be enhanced if taught in the right way, and being taught in the right way means actually ensuring that there's visual cues all the way through. And guess what? Your eyesight is important for that. And so really, if they're doing it right, and if they actually are supporting, then they'll be saying, they're visual learners, make sure you get their eyes checked.
Yes. I would hope that message is getting over. Hospitals, to my mind, use the key age of 18 months to 2 years, because in typical children, that's the age that you know whether they're growing out of those baby errors or not. Mm. And that's the age at which you would start to think about spectacles for those few children who have maintained long sight or short sight. And squints as well, in typical children, tend to appear at around the age of two. So it's sort of a sensible time if you look at it from the hospital's perspective. It is a sensible time to start checking up on the children. Okay. I like to start earlier than that. I like to see the children when they're much younger so I can prepare parents for the likelihood that their child is going to need to wear spectacles, but also because, and you all know this because you're parents, that the age of two is the most difficult age to do anything with a child.
Yeah.
So trying to do a first eye examination with a two-year-old is a real challenge, and that applies to any two-year-old, whether they have Down syndrome or not.
Yeah. You've got an 18-month-old in your clinic. I mean, how do you even begin to do an eye test?
Well, I've got, 40 years of experience behind me. So to me, it's bread and butter. In fact, I always tell people that if you give me a patient who can answer back, I'm out of my comfort zone. So we can measure long or short sight very easily by a technique called retinoscopy, in which we shine a light from what looks like a torch into the child's eyes and look at the light that's reflected back.
Right.
Because just like cat's eyes, our eyes reflect light back. But our eyes don't do it as efficiently as cat's eyes. We're not used to saying, you know, seeing our eyes shine in the dark. So we have to direct the light particularly away and put the lights out and all this sort of thing. But nevertheless, the light does come back. Now, if your eyes are out of focus, it means light entering your eyes is out of focus, and therefore light coming back reflected towards me from your eyes is also out of focus. Wow. And I can look at that light, judge its out of focusness.
Right.
And then I can hold lenses up in front of your eyes to get that light that's returning back to me in focus. And that way I can measure very precisely long sight, short sight.
So is that what those round little disc things do? It's the light coming back. Because I always wonder when they're doing this, even to us, I'm like, well, how do you know what I can see? But they're looking for the light.
Yeah, we're doing it completely objectively. When we test an adult like yourself, we can ask you questions, aren't we? We can say to you, now, does this lens make it better? Mm-hmm. Or do you prefer this one? And so on. We can't do that with a child, so we just have to be a little more rigorous
right,
in doing it our way. But there's no reason why we can't accurately measure your long or short sight.
Okay. So I've got my older two kids. We've got Kush and Kira. Kush wears glasses. Kira doesn't. But say if they both did. So I've got typical Kira. Kush has Down syndrome. Say if they both had the same prescription for the glasses, would they be seeing in exactly the same way?
Now, this is the other important difference between typical children and children with Down syndrome. Okay. All children at birth have very poor vision indeed.
Right.
And that vision develops very, very quickly. So their ability to see detail appears very quickly in the first months of life.
Yeah.
And in typical children, it carries on improving until they're about four. In children with Down syndrome, it starts off exactly the same as typical children, very rapidly improves, but it levels off at the age of about two.
Okay.
So from that age, the gap between what a typical child is seeing and a child with Down syndrome is seeing widens slightly.
Right.
But then it stays constant because the typical children eventually level off as well. So if you think of a letter chart,
yeah,
which is the usual way we use to measure how well you can see, children with Down syndrome are 2 to 3 lines behind typical children, and they go on to maintain that difference.
Oh, wow.
Throughout life. So children with Down syndrome are not seeing in quite so much detail.
Okay. Even with the specs?
That's with the specs. Obviously, if they need specs and aren't wearing them, their vision's going to be even worse. Yeah. But the best they can do is 2 to 3 lines on a letter chart poorer. Now, in daily life, it doesn't make a lot of difference. And the easiest way to describe it is that children with Down syndrome see the world in soft focus.
Okay.
If you picture a soft focus scene, it's slightly fuzzy, slightly pastely, no sharp corners, no really bright hues. And in fact, we find it rather pleasant, don't we?
Yeah.
And theatrical lighting engineers spend a lot of effort trying to make things in soft focus because it's something we actually like. And that's how children with Down syndrome see all the time. So around the house, it doesn't make much difference, and you would not be aware of it.
Okay.
But when we push children's eyes to the limit, which is what we do in schools, it makes a difference. So, for example, teachers have known for years that children with Down syndrome find it very difficult to write on the lines.
Yes.
And they have always thought that this is because the children have poor fine motor control. Mm. And it's not. It's because the lines are so faint, the children can't see them.
Right. Okay.
And if the teachers go over the lines in black pen, the children can write on the lines. Now, can you imagine how frustrating it is for a child with Down syndrome in school, constantly being told by the teacher, put your letters on the lines?
They just can't see it.
They can't see any lines.
Can you, or has it been done before, simulate that so that we can see and appreciate looking through the eyes of a child with Down syndrome?
Yes. Okay. If you're listening to a podcast, the next little bit isn't going to make much sense. But if you're watching this on a video, this will. What I have here is a filter, what at first sight looks like a transparent piece of filter, okay, which in fact is a part of what the optical lighting engineers use to create soft focus. They put this over lights to create soft focus. Yeah. And if I fold this filter in half and look through it, I see, as far as we can tell, the way a child with Down syndrome does. So I'm just going to put this over my camera and you might be able to see me in soft focus, slightly washed out. And if you write in pencil and look through this, you'll find you can't read what you've written. If you write in black pen or in very soft pencil, which instead of being HB, which is what we used to, it's 8 to 10B, which are artists' extremely soft pencil, and then look through the filter, you will be able to read it easily. So the only change around the home that I would recommend that parents make is to buy their children soft pencils for scribbling.
Yeah.
Use wax crayons instead of pencil crayons, because they're quite soft colours, and wax crayons are much, much brighter.
Yeah.
And other than that, there isn't much you can do. But once a child gets to school, it's absolutely vital that the teachers are aware that even if this child has got the right spectacles on, they are not seeing as well as the other children in the classroom. And the teacher needs to allow the children to write, not in pencil, but either in black pen or in soft pencil.
You say often on this, it's the case that, you know, we really see, particularly with, you know, people that support our children outside of the house, that when they get a sense on how they are experiencing the world is where they actually sit up and take notice and say, okay, actually, we
absolutely, right. yes. So, these filters are invaluable, and I hand them out willy-nilly to any parent who comes to my clinic, and I post them to schools.
Perfect.
Wow.
And I'm perfectly willing to, I mean, I don't know how many people are listening to this.
We're going to sign this up.
Thousands. But, you know, I'm perfectly willing to tell people how to get hold of them themselves, and maybe groups could. They come in sheets, but they also come on in huge rolls, and I buy a huge roll because I use a lot of it. But it costs about £80. But if you've got an enormous number of families in a parent support group, then it's nothing, is it? It's really important that
I think both of us straight away, I'm going to get my hands on some of that film and take it straight to school and say, look, this is what he's saying. So I think, we'll get those details from you and link it, or just at least people will be able to know how to contact you. Or as you say, maybe groups can get together and if you can direct them to where they can get it. So that being said then, you've got your child with Down syndrome, they're at school, they're learning. There's a lot of focus on speech and language therapy, on vision therapy, occupational therapy, you know, all of those sorts of things. But actually, if your child can't see very well, that's going to have a knock-on effect on how all of those things integrate. So actually, this is a fundamental area.
It is, absolutely. Even things like speech and language therapy, SLTs use visual material to teach the child.
And if it's all around,
it may be that the children are struggling to see what speech and language therapist is giving to them. Yeah. So all professionals would benefit from understanding what vision is like to a child with Down syndrome.
So also then, when we're talking about schools and learning, I think we've actually been quite lucky in the area that we're in. And we know, well, I know from obviously talking to a lot of parents and friends that, you know, provision and services differ quite widely depending on county and your local authority. Now, that's a whole separate conversation, I guess. But I think the basis is that even if your child has glasses, so we have been linked into the visual impairment team. And firstly, I was like, well, what do you mean? I mean, he's just got glasses. Why is he with the visual impairment team? And then they explained to me exactly what it is they do. Could you just talk to us a little bit about visual impairment teams, what they do and how they support children in school? And is it something that every child with Down syndrome should be linked into? And how can parents get access? Do you know a bit about that?
Right, the visual impairment team, every educational authority has a team which consists of qualified teachers of the visually impaired, right, referred to as QTVIs, and they support children with vision loss.
Okay.
Now, I would love to see every child with Down syndrome supported by a QTVI.
Yeah.
Their job, when you're dealing with children such as we are talking about, that is children who are not totally blind, because they obviously support children who are, and they teach Braille and other sorts of aids and so on. So they've got a very wide remit. But when you're talking about a child who sees but doesn't see quite as well, the QTVI's job is to educate the classroom teacher,
right,
and the teaching assistant. So they wouldn't be teaching the child. They would assess how the child is coping with whatever material the teacher is providing and judge whether that's adequate or not. And so they would probably visit some children just once a term or once a year, if everything's going okay. But if they judge that the material isn't adequate because the teacher doesn't understand how the child with visual with Down syndrome is seeing, they will give some guidelines and recommendations of what the teacher needs to do, how they need to modify the material. So they work, if you like, with the teacher to get the teachers doing what is appropriate for the child. And that's relevant because the teachers are there every day, aren't they? Now, varying around the country is the criterion for referral to the VI service.
Right.
And some areas don't have a fixed criterion. They will support any child whose vision is giving cause for concern. In some areas, all children with Down syndrome are automatically supported. In other areas, there is a fixed criterion for how bad your vision has to be before the VI team will get involved. And in most areas that have that fixed criterion, the children with Down syndrome don't meet it. Their vision is too good.
Oh my gosh.
So there are children who cannot be supported by their local VI service because the criterion is fixed. Getting that criterion changed would be an enormous challenge. And I'm sure the VI teachers in those areas would love to change their criterion. They don't set the criterion, it's management that set it.
Maggie, you need to get down to those local authorities with your film and stick it in front of their eyes and be like, right,
yes,
now.
Yes, yes, you're absolutely right. Perhaps we ought to get a huge campaign going. You're absolutely right. If the people that make these rules looked through this, they themselves would struggle to do their job.
Yeah.
And then they'd know that children with Down syndrome need help.
It's just another battle, isn't it? Stuff like that makes me really upset and angry, because you just think, this poor child who's already not on a level playing field, you know, parents are trying to fight for the right provision, but actually their child can't even see what's being put in front of them.
Yes, it is a battle, and I've got the greatest admiration for what parents have to go through. And I get frustrated and angry just about the vision side of things, and that's only one component of the support a child with Down syndrome needs. And the parents might be battling on all fronts, mightn't they? Speech and language, physiotherapy.
Yeah,
it's really important, because I think with provision of all sorts for supports with our children, there's a cost to it, right? We've got to be honest, there is a cost to it that is coming from the government, local authorities.
Yes.
And of course, we all get it. There isn't some sort of endless pot of money that can support every single child. That can be understood and accepted if actually the base level of support across schools generally was in a good place, and they're not. They're absolutely not.
You're absolutely right.
the worst thing about it, I'm going off on a rant now, is the support that we provide means that they can go on to have fulfilling lives and provide back to society more. And so it's like, actually, invest early, you know, provide that support, which means actually later down the line, you'll reap the benefits.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that is the argument, isn't it? And really, compared to some of the expenses that governments go through,
wow.
What we're asking. Podcast.
It's another theme. Oh, wow. Let's talk about a child got glasses, you know, that they're getting regular checks, et cetera, et cetera. Now, talk to me about the glasses specifically. So there's always conversations about the different frames, the different lenses. What's your advice to a parent that's looking at this?
Well, one thing I need to begin with is the fact that the other big difference between children with Down syndrome and typical children is in the issue of changing focus to see clearly at near.
Right.
Okay. The spectacles that we're talking about, long sight and short sight, will make children's vision clear at distance. And then, in order to see clearly at near, what we all have to do is to use the muscles within the eye, change the shape of the lens in the eye to focus on something close to us.
Okay.
Now, typical children do that very readily. Some children with Down syndrome can do that readily, but the majority of children with Down syndrome struggle to make that change of focus to look at something close to them. So that even when they've got their glasses on to correct long and short sight, what they're looking at close to them is out of focus.
Right.
What we do for that is use bifocals, which are spectacles that have two parts to them. Top part corrects long or short sight, and the bottom part gives an extra boost to focusing.
Okay.
So that the children can now see clearly at near. And that is really important.
And what age would you recommend using what they're called bifocals? And actually, isn't that quite difficult for a child to learn which one to use when?
We use bifocals from the age at which a child can sit upright.
Wow.
And look down to do whatever it is they're doing, playing, scribbling, looking at a book and what have you. So for most children, that's 2 years, maybe 2.5 to 3. But you know, before they get to 3, most children are sitting up and looking down naturally to what they are doing. Wow. So we fit bifocals to children who are not focusing accurately at that very young age.
Wow.
And now, to answer your other question, we by now, I don't know how many we fitted, but we are in the hundreds of children that we have prescribed bifocals to. And there are some children who haven't got on with them.
Right.
But there are so few, I could actually tell you their names.
Oh my God.
I'm not going to. But it is very, very unusual for a child not to be able to cope with bifocals. That came as a surprise to us because this started out as a research study, and we did think that children might struggle to know where to look.
Yeah.
But they don't. They take to them really, really easily because in order to see into the distance, they need to look slightly up.
Mm.
Well, children on the whole are shorter than adults. So most of their looking at other people and looking into the distance is naturally looking slightly upwards.
Yeah. Mm.
And to use the bifocal, they have to look down, and they do that naturally anyway.
Wow.
Because they're sitting and looking down. We fit the bifocals high so that they only have to drop their eyes by a tiny amount to find the bifocal.
Okay.
Yeah. And they take to them really, really easily. When we first started using bifocals, we used to make sure the children had two pairs of specs, one bifocals and one ordinary. And we used to say, wear the bifocals in school, and when you finish school for the day, change back into your ordinary specs, because we wanted to minimise the problems. And most of the children just refused to put their ordinary specs back on.
Yeah.
They made their choice to keep their bifocals on all the time.
I suppose we missed a bit on that point. We're talking about bifocals, an important, obviously, topic and subject, but I suppose the bit before that is getting the glasses on and keeping them on.
Now, this is my all-time favourite subject. The key is you do it at your child's pace, not your pace. Okay, you never try to persuade your child to keep their glasses on all the time. You allow the child to decide when to wear their specs, and most of the children will decide they want to wear them all the time. But you have to take it very, very slowly. So depending on how tolerant your child is to something on their face, and some children hate anything on their head or face, don't they? You start with either a second of spectacle wear, or perhaps if they don't mind the feel of them, just half a minute looking at a book or doing something that they will get benefit from the spectacles for, and then you take the spectacles off for them.
Okay.
Always try to anticipate your child's tolerance.
Okay.
So that it never becomes a battle.
Yeah.
They never get to the stage of snatching their specs off and throwing them across the room. And however long they have them on for once a day this week, you make it a bit longer next week. So if this week it's a second a day, next week it's 2 seconds.
Right, okay. So you just gradually build.
Well, it takes... Be prepared for it to take months.
Wow, okay.
And then, if it only takes weeks,
Very true, very true.
Some children do take months, some children take weeks, but what you're aiming for is the child to make their own decision ultimately how long they wear them for. Now, for most children, they really don't have to wear them all the time. They might prefer just to wear them for close work, just wear them for television, and going without them is not harmful at all.
Yeah.
The exception to that are children who've got a squint, that is, they have one eye that turns and the specs straighten it.
Okay, yeah.
And for those children, the ideal is full-time wear. But for others, if they never get to full time, it doesn't matter. But in our experience, most children do, because they decide for themselves. I actually like seeing clearly, so I think I'm going to leave my specs on. But if you try to rush them, you'll just end up in a battle, a battle that you will lose.
So, I think that's what we did with Kush. We put them on him when we knew it was something that he needed, like it was high visual kind of interactions. I think it was singing hands or something we put on the TV. Mm. We put his glasses on. And I think he started to notice the difference quite immediately. So that after like a few weeks, he was not letting us take them off, because I think he realised these are actually helping me. It's like he opened him up to a new world. So,
that's great. But unfortunately... some hospitals and optometrists give the instruction, your child must wear these all the time. And parents interpret that to mean if their child doesn't wear them all the time, their eyes are going to get worse.
Right.
So they get very fearful and anxious about their child wearing glasses. And then when the child is being reluctant, their parents' anxiety makes the children worse because they pass that anxiety about spectacles onto their child. And if the child doesn't wear their glasses all the time, their eyes will not get worse. It won't do them any harm at all. You need to take that guilt and that fear away and just let the child decide for themselves. After all, when your child starts wearing shoes, some children don't wear shoes much, do they? They don't like them to start with.
Yeah.
But you don't worry about that because nobody's suggested
that
not wearing shoes will make their feet worse. So it's just another example of parents of children with Down syndrome being primed to worry.
Well, just on that topic, I suppose, of worry and guilt in particular, I think one thing that all parents will resonate with over the last years, kind of trying to teach their children whilst being in lockdown, and obviously trying to also crack on with their kind of their kind of jobs and stuff, that the iPad has come into use. And what basically. And I think what we found and have always found with Kush is he gets really close to the screen.
Like
he wants to get
through it. It's like he's trying to get through it. And we're like, move, you know, when my mum sees him do that, she's like, he's going to ruin his eyes, move it away. Why is he doing that? And should I be taking him away?
You've hit on my second favourite. Because almost every parent I talk to says exactly the same. Okay, what I want you to do is to imagine looking at an iPad.
Yeah.
So you're sitting down, you've got the iPad, you know, on your lap or whatever, it doesn't matter. Or you're sitting watching the television.
Okay.
You can see what's on the screen, but you can also see everything that's around the screen.
Right.
Right.
And there are lots of other things in the room that are around and visible to you out of the corner of your eye.
Yeah.
Now, you and I have learned to ignore those distractions. And we've now got the skill to concentrate on what's on the screen, what we want to look at, and ignore everything else.
Wow.
Now, little children haven't yet learned that skill, and children with a learning disability are much more challenged by distractions. They find it much harder to concentrate when there are distractions around the screen. So the obvious thing to do is bring the screen closer, fill all of your vision with the screen,
and
then you can concentrate on it.
So it's actually quite smart.
Absolutely. And it is exactly what we do when we go to the cinema, because we sit and watch a screen that completely fills our vision and we put the lights out. So your child is just doing exactly the same, and there is no evidence whatsoever that getting close to the screen, the telly, a book or anything will damage their eyes.
That's the main bit
That's the silver bullet right there.
That's the one for the grandparents.
My mum, if you're listening, there you go. Thank you, Maggie. That's brilliant. Right. So we've covered off, you know, from birth, things we need to look after, years at school and interventions from the VI team. So as they grow, what is it that parents and carers need to keep on top of? Is it always going to be such frequent visits for checks?
When children are very little and their eyes are changing rapidly before they're four.
Yeah.
Okay. Frequent visits, because you can have quite marked changes at that age. Okay.
Yeah.
If everything is okay from four onwards, I would say annually.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. But then when children get towards their teens, there is a condition called keratoconus.
Okay.
That can crop up.
Right.
And that, if it happens, needs to be picked up at the very earliest opportunity. Now, keratoconus is a condition of the cornea in which the cornea, the transparent curved window at the front of the eye, starts to grow out into a cone shape. That's why it's called keratoconus. Okay. Right. So vision starts to get distorted. And if it progresses, the cornea can become quite fragile because the cornea is getting thinner as it's growing outwards, and it can form scars.
Right.
So ultimately, it can cause quite a severe visual impairment.
Okay.
Now, this, like everything else, occurs in the general population, but it is more common in Down syndrome, and we think it's about 10% of young people with Down syndrome who are going to go on to develop it.
Okay.
And now, so it's quite difficult to diagnose it in the very early stages, but in the very early stages, it is treatable.
Okay.
And there's a new therapy called cross-linkage, which is perfectly viable for people with Down syndrome. I know quite a lot of young people who've had the procedure, and it requires either a local anaesthetic, or for some people that can't keep still, a general anaesthetic, and it halts the progression. So it's really, really important in maintaining good vision.
Okay.
So right through teenage years, or approaching teenage, say from 11 onwards, people with Down syndrome should continue, even if they've got, don't need glasses, even if they've had everything fine so far, still need to keep up annual visits.
Okay.
And they need to have annual visits with an optometrist who can check carefully for keratoconus.
Okay.
Right, so parents need...
Annual is still enough at that point when you're...
Yes, yes.
Annual's enough. Yeah.
But no longer.
Fine.
Right.
And that's...
If there's a suspicion of keratoconus, then the optometrist may move to 3 months or 6 months.
Okay.
But if everything's going fine, I think annually is enough.
Okay. And what sort of sign, can parents pick up symptoms and signs of that? Or is it just general deterioration of eyesight?
No, it would be very, very unlikely that anyone would notice.
Okay.
Until it got to a severe stage, beyond the stage at which it is treatable with this
procedure.
Okay. Ultimately, a corneal graft.
Right.
Is the treatment for the very late stage.
Yeah.
But what we want to do is never allow it ever to get to that stage, because this new treatment is absolutely life-changing for the typical people that have keratoconus as well as people with Down syndrome. So that's really important. Yeah. If once someone's in their mid-20s, they're no longer at risk of getting keratoconus. And if everything's going okay, 2 years might be okay. But if someone wanted to keep going every year, I wouldn't argue.
Okay. So that's good to know. So then when you're in your 20s, that risk reduces. But then I guess as we all get older, so generally, you know, I mean, my eyes have deteriorated as I've got older. You do get more age-related kind of vision issues or challenges. Does that happen at the same rate in people with Down syndrome? You're laughing at me.
I know. Isn't life sad? You just get over your teenage years. And old age starts to creep in. But it does. It does. Fortunately, old age goes on for a very long time. And it's not as bad as people make it. That's speaking from personal experience. What happens to all of us as we get older is the lens in the eye that changes shape to allow us to focus at near becomes rigid and can't change shape as readily. So we all lose the ability to focus at near. And we're all used to people in their 40s and 50s. Their arms are too short. They're reading, you know. And we take to reading glasses.
Right. Okay.
Now that will happen to people with Down syndrome because it happens to absolutely everybody. Right. What we don't know is whether it happens at a younger age in Down syndrome. In the general population, it's 45 to 50 when we start to really become aware of that issue. Obviously, there's individual variations, but we really don't know whether it occurs earlier in people with Down syndrome. If I'm around for long enough, our cohort of people with Down syndrome who we've been following since early childhood are now in their late 20s, early 30s.
Wow.
So if I can hang on there in there for a bit.
You will.
I might be able to answer that question. But at the moment, I can't. But obviously, near focusing is something that people should be checking with anyone with Down syndrome.
Fine.
At every visit.
And Maggie, you said that we want parents to be taking their children to people that can check thoroughly and properly. In my books, that basically is only you.
We come to you.
But of course, not everyone's going to be able to get to you. So what would you say to the people who can't get to you?
Well, I have a list of people who I know personally, some of whom will have trained with me or done short courses with me and so on, all around the country, all around the UK, who have an interest in people with Down syndrome and have the experience and the skills to see people with Down syndrome. So wherever you live, there'll be someone within reach. They may not be on your doorstep. It may be half an hour's drive away, but I can find somebody for you. And that number is going up all the time because people are getting more and more interested. People are realizing how fulfilling it is in your working life to be able to help people with disabilities. So anyone can email me and I will give them that list or the appropriate part of the list for their area. There is probably other optometrists who I don't know who are equally skilled and equally good. So if any families come across an optometrist who they would recommend to other parents, please let me know as well and I'll add them to my list.
Amazing.
Because obviously the children deserve the best and that's what we want to give them.
That is going to be just absolute music to many people's ears, Maggie. Thank you so, so much. You've been an absolute pleasure to talk to. I could talk to you for hours and hours. So just to end with, this is how we end kind of all our podcasts. We will start you off with a sentence and we would like you to finish them. So we've got three of them here for you.
Here we go. The first one. For new parents starting their journey with a child who has Down syndrome, please remember
that he or she is your son or daughter first.
Brilliant. Thank you.
And the Down syndrome is a bit of an add-on.
Brilliant. The second one is, for any parent thinking they haven't had the right input with vision, you should...
I'm tempted to say, get in touch with me and I'll fix it.
Perfect.
That's brilliant. And then the final one, the best thing about working with people with additional needs is...
the characters, particularly people with Down syndrome, that extra chromosome gives them extra personality. So every single one is a real character. And what people who don't work in the field don't realise is that every individual with a disability is also different.
Yeah.
We tend to generalise, don't we? But we shouldn't because everyone is different. So in my job, I have no routine at all. I gear what I do entirely to the child or adult who's in front of me. So I do something different in every eye examination. And that is the joy in my job, that I never get bored.
That's amazing.
Oh, Maggie.
What a wonderful note to end on.
It really is. You have been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll link all your details so anyone can get in touch. But thank you.
That's lovely. Bye.
Beautiful girl with a beautiful smile in a beautiful heart.
Coffee and Chromosomes is brought to you by the charity Wouldn't Change a Thing, creating a world where negative perceptions of Down syndrome are a thing of the past. If you'd like to hear about a particular topic or from a certain individual, email us at podcast@wouldn'tchangeathing.org.